want to welcome everyone again to the fourth of our Monday evening agriculture webinars. These webinars are organized by the CCL Agricultural Action Team in order to better inform ourselves across CCL about issues related to agriculture, because we realized in building relationships that with farmers and other agricultural stakeholders that we really needed to take a step back and get a better handle on what farmers and stakeholders had to tell us. So we had to step back and listen, but we also needed to learn a lot about the world in which they live and operate. We need to learn about the farm bill and all the economic issues, a lot of issues related to the intersection of rural and farming communities. And so this first series of webinars has been intended to kind of be maybe a freshman survey course in issues that we're kind of touching on a lot of the critical issues in agriculture. So we started out with an overview by Connor Stedman, and we heard from, and I'm telling you, Sean, as well, we heard from the National Sustainable Agriculture Coalition, who laid out for us the structure of the Farm Bill and talked about their policy priorities. And then last week, we heard perspectives from the National, from Tom Driscoll of the National Farmers Union, and he laid out kind of where that particular advocacy organization is coming from and what their policy priorities are for. So this week, I am so happy to have Sean Babington from the Senate Agriculture Committee, and I am very happy to turn the speaker over to Kelly Lively for just a few minutes, who's very active in following farm bill developments and is going to give us a little bit of an introduction into what Sean is going to talk about.
Thanks, Jan. So I've been following along with the farm bill in the Senate. I haven't been following what they're doing in the House, but watching the hearings and trying to find the places where it intersects with climate. One of the things that I found that is probably really important for our organization, for our advocacy, is to remember that while a lot of these issues in the Farm Bill are rural issues that have to do with especially the climate, when we take out the nutrition piece, you know, put that in a separate spot, not out of the Farm Bill, but the way that our Senate and our House are, the population there is coming, much of it is coming from urban areas, and they may not care so much about the rural areas and may not really care about agriculture, but everybody eats. Agriculture is one of our, you know, contributes about 29% of the greenhouse gases, and it is also an opportunity to create a lot of great solutions to our problem with climate change. So following the Farm Bill, because it's such a huge omnibus piece of legislation, we need to be familiar with it. We need to be able to talk to our lawmakers. We need to talk to our friends and our families about it. Toward that effort, we're really happy that Sean Babington from the Senate Agriculture Committee, a staffer, professional staffer there, has agreed to speak with us tonight about how Congress and the Farm Bill can drive smart agriculture. Sean is a professional staffer on the U.S. Senate's Committee on Agriculture, Nutrition, and Forestry, and he handles the committee's business on energy, climate change, forestry, and pesticides. So we're looking forward to learning from him how the confirmation process for executive branch nominees and the current work that's going on drafting the 2018 Farm Bill offer opportunities for the Agriculture Committee to accelerate climate smart agriculture across rural America. And therein, that's what we really need to know about. And it's important that we be able to advocate these policies with our lawmakers. So with that, Sean, I think you can take it from there. Thanks for joining us.
Great. Appreciate you guys having me, and thanks for that really generous and warm introduction. So, I work for Senator Debbie Stabenow on the minority side of the U.S. Senate Committee on Agriculture, Nutrition, Forestry. I've been in that position about 2.5 years now. Before that, I worked for the office of United States Senator Michael Bennett from Colorado. I worked on some of these same issues and did my undergraduate at the University of Colorado Boulder, my master's in D.C. here in Georgetown, and really focused on some of these environmental, climate, sustainability issues. And I'm thinking in terms of an agenda, I was going to go out a little bit of a summary on where we are with the nominations process so far, the writing of the next farm bill, how that dialogue and the process is moving along, maybe transition a little bit into what past farm bills have done and are still doing on climate smart agriculture, on renewable energy in rural America, and something, you know, these sort of groups of policies that the last administration really called the USDA building blocks for climate smart agriculture. And then maybe finish with just talking briefly about what I see coming up this next time, where neither chamber, the House or the Senate, is written or marked up or a full farm bill yet, but we can talk a little bit about that. And more than anything, I just love to have a dialogue, answer questions, and get to hear your perspective on these things too and your questions. So if that works for everyone else, I'll just dive right in. The timing for us is, you know, we're moving along what we would describe as expeditiously to evaluate and confirm the president's nominees to be political appointees at the Department of Agriculture. As many of you know, the Senate's prerogative is to advise and consent and confirm these nominees. The House doesn't have to worry about that, so we have 14 political positions at the U.S. Department of Agriculture that require Senate confirmation. And thus far, we've only managed to do a handful of them. So the Secretary Perdue, was the former governor of Georgia, was one that we did promptly after we got that nomination. And we've been doing the various undersecretaries in the months since then. But still have several positions that have not yet been nominated. Last I checked, I didn't pull up these numbers for this call, but this administration was about 3 or 4 months behind where the last administration was at this time in terms of getting people up. And that's not a value judgment as much as just an observation. So we've got that really taken up a lot of our time on the committee. We've got when someone's nominated to a position like this, we go through a really extensive and thorough vetting process of their professional credentials, their academic credentials. We do staff interviews with these nominees. Then we do a full committee hearing in a full and open committee setting. Then we do what's called a markup or a business meeting. For those who remember Civics 101 or I'm Just a Bill, and, you know, literally everybody just going and voting yes or no. And if they've got a majority, then that nominee is reported out, and is the term out here, to the full Senate. And then the full Senate gets to vote on them. So several of you probably saw earlier this year that the current majority leader, Senator McConnell, went through a process to change the threshold for confirming executive branch nominees. So that threshold is just 50 votes, where it used to be 60. So a lot of these folks have not, in other departments, have not garnered the traditional 60 votes. I think we're lucky in agriculture for a lot of reasons that we actually do have usually a pretty good bipartisan spirit on most of the things we do. And so far on the nominees we voted on, that's held true. So, you know, we'll see where that heads. But we have spent months and months evaluating the nominees we have gotten, doing hearings, and at the same time working on our farm bill oversight hearings. So the federal farm bill, many of you are very familiar with it, but it's a very large, you know, 1,000+ page piece of legislation and covers everything from, as was alluded to earlier, the SNAP program, which many people know as food stamps, all the way to how we manage our national forest lands to balance the multiple uses of those and all the competing interests who are interested in our federal public lands. So it's a pretty wide-ranging piece of legislation. And we do a hearing on every single title that the bill has and hear from stakeholders on this is what you did right last time, this is what could be improved, we hate this program completely and should get rid of it. And, you know, we're just finished our last hearing. We actually did the rural development and energy titles a couple weeks ago. So we're moving right along. And I think that the expectation and the end of our farm bill hearings, and I actually just completed them a couple weeks ago. So now I think we're going to be moving towards actually drafting some text, going through that same process I mentioned with the nominees. We'll do markup where members will have an opportunity to offer amendments to improve or change the bill. Ideally, we're going to be then passing that bill through committee, reporting it out to the full Senate floor on a bipartisan basis and having a robust floor debate before the Senate passes their bill. Then the House has to do the exact same process. They will likely be different bills, at which point we go to what's called a conference committee, where we try and reconcile the differences between the two versions, and then go back and once again vote on a final, what they call a conference report. And that's what, if passed, goes to the president's desk to be signed. For a sense of how long this took last time, the last farm bill actually expired at the end of, I want to say September in 2012, but there were some fits and starts. The House at the time tried to split off the food stamp portion of the bill from the traditional commodity conservation, where your nuts and bolts farming and agriculture, and they failed to pass the bill through the House in a combined fashion. So we lost over a year playing some games with the House, but eventually February of 2014, we signed the most current bill into law. It took almost 3 weeks of debate on the Senate floor and 70 some votes on amendments. To give you a sense of how long that took, a good rule of thumb for how long voting on one amendment takes is a half hour. So you can imagine how long it took us to get through 70 some. So it was a process. We got there. And now this next one's up for reauthorization just under a year from now. It expires in September of 2018. And from our part, you know, from our perspective, Senator Stabenow, my boss, Chairman Roberts, Chairman Conaway in the House, and his ranking member, who's a gentleman by the name of Colin Peterson from Minnesota, those are the chairman and ranking in each chamber, are all very committed to really trying to get this bill done on time and give folks, both in the farming and ranching community, but also our foresters, our soil conservationists, everyone who cares about the farm bill, some certainty moving forward. So with that, I was going to move into a little bit of what the bill and the Department of Agriculture do right now on Climate Smart Ag. And then, you know, like I said, maybe move into a couple ideas that are out there that we're still looking to get a little bit more solidified and, you know, move into the debate on the next one. So I kind of mentioned that the last administration was very, very aggressive on climate change issues. And that's, you know, I would say probably fair to say across all departments. At the Department of Ag, the Secretary Vilsack, and his Undersecretary for Natural Resources and Environment, a guy by the name of Robert Bonney, were, you know, really thorough in trying to say, okay, here are all the programs at our disposal that have a potential climate mitigating or climate sequestering benefit, and really committed to both getting those things all together in an organized fashion, and then putting some benchmarks in place to think about how the USDA can maximize the working lands that we have, the carbon sequestration potential we have, and also our mitigation opportunities on rural lands. Efficiency, electricity generation, digesters, all sorts of things like that. So I can go into really great detail on some of these things, and maybe we'll get into that in the questions. For now, I was going to just kind of broadly lay out three buckets that I kind of categorize those policies into. The first is using a program called the USDA's Conservation Innovation Grants, or SIG, sometimes they're called. Using some grants and resources under that program to help farmers who are doing climate smart agriculture, no-till type of tillage, other practices like in rice in Arkansas that are producing much less methane than the traditional rice operation would, and taking those farmers who are really out front and early adopters on these climate smart ag practices and helping using these conservation innovation grant dollars to help those farmers participate in carbon markets. At this point, it's largely been in the private sector, sort of the open market. So the two examples I like to talk about are a grassland conservation proposal from North Dakota, where USDA came in and partnered with Ducks Unlimited, some North Dakota ranchers, a host of other local partners on the ground to manage some grassland up there to greatly increase the carbon sequestration potential of the acreage. And once they put in place a regime for monitoring, verification, accounting, they were able to partner with private sector folks who verify all these reductions and sell the carbon credits to Chevy on the open market, because they wanted to have a certain vehicle or certain aspect of their marketing be carbon neutral. You know, so that was like an example from a few years ago. More recently, USDA has been partnering with rice farmers in Arkansas to do similar practices on their operations. Rice is a very methane intensive crop in terms of the emissions, but a few tweaks on how you irrigate it and timing and other things can really reduce that emissions potential. So the farmers who took that up worked with USDA and some of these other folks like the Climate Trust and other outfits that really are experts in getting the credits verified and put in place a monitoring regime. And they were able to sell their carbon credits to Microsoft, who wanted to have a similar offset to some piece of their business. So USDA has been doing that since the 2008 Farm Bill. Not all carbon conservation innovation grants are a pretty open-ended opportunity, but it's an interesting and I think one of the more exciting things that USDA currently has at its disposal. So that's one bucket. I say helping farmers who are doing the right thing participate in the markets we do have. All of you know pretty well that we're without a federal climate policy at the moment. I was working for Senator Bennett from Colorado when we tried to do the nationwide cap and trade approach. I actually remember meeting with several of your colleagues at the time back in that office on cap and dividend and some other things. So happy to talk about that. It's bringing back some memories, but so without that, you know, we're looking largely at the private sector. There are people very interested in California, Reggie in the Northeast, potentially some other things with what the Canadians are doing. But we are very excited about the conservation innovation grants and what USDA has done and hopefully will continue to do. The second bucket for Climate Smart Ag and the Department of Agriculture and what we're interested in the committee is really helping farmers be empowered to be part of the solution, right? We've got farming practices and sort of what types of issues that presents, but We've also got the opportunity for a lot of farmers who use an awful lot of fuel, an awful lot of electricity, or have houses, barns, other infrastructure that are all energy inefficient, to use USDA dollars, almost exclusively supplied by the Farm Bill that we passed through Congress, to upgrade their systems to deploy renewable energy in rural areas. The signature program that I'm thinking of here, and that some of you may have heard of, is called the Rural Energy for America program, or sometimes referred to as REAP. And that gives $50 million annually to interested stakeholders across the country, as I'm getting my internet connected again, so hopefully I'm still coming through here, gives interested stakeholders and producers from across the country the opportunity to apply to USDA for loans and grants to literally install a solar array or a small wind turbine on their property, and thereby offset a whole host of electricity use from their local electric co-op or even their investor-owned utility. Same loans and grants are also available for energy efficiency upgrades. So another, you know, thing that a lot of folks in rural America have been taking advantage of. We've got something like three times more qualified interested parties and applications every fiscal year than we have available money. That is something that Senator Stabenow, my boss, has expressed a lot of interest in trying to increase and leverage to get even more good climate smart practices and renewable energy deployed out in rural America. But it's a pretty cool program. You know, you can just type in USDA REAP into Google and you'll find it in no time. It's financed something like 12,000 projects across the country since it started in 2002. And that's roughly 750,000 homes, annual energy bills, completely, and annual carbon completely offset thanks to this Farm Bill program. So that's the second bucket, renewable energy efficiency in rural parts of the country. There are several other programs related to the REAP program that help producers of advanced biofuels and folks who want to install these systems to help offset actual farm intense, you know, energy intensive farm equipment, like a center pivot irrigation system or some sort of pump for a water right. And those programs are spread between the Farm Bill's conservation title and the Farm Bill's energy title. And I'm happy to talk more about those later. But the third bucket that I wanted to just touch on before we reach the halfway point of the hour here and we can move into a discussion is something that is really about protecting carbon sinks through our forests and our soils. One of the chief programs that we think about in this context is called the Forest Legacy Program. It was originally created through a farm bill. And if anybody from Vermont is around, or probably even just know this guy from reputation, it was created by Senator Patrick Leahy, who's a former chairman of the Senate Ag Committee and is still a senior member of the committee and sits right next to Senator Stabenow on the panel. And this idea is basically to allow the U.S. Forest Service and interested land trusts to go ahead and help cement either a conservation easement or an outright federal purchase of parcels of land and forest land that, you know, meet high ranking environmental criteria. So, you know, you can talk about things like carbon sequestration, threatened and endangered species habitat, important recreational access. But we're talking about large swaths of forest land, which I'm sure most of the folks on the call know can be very important in keeping our carbon balance in a relatively stable place. Everyone knows that, not everyone, but most of you know, tropical deforestation and even some of our old growth deforestation is a really, unfortunately, a big driver of climate change. So this program helps to keep those trees standing and stop them from either, being logged or even just parceled up for development. That a lot of people don't know that the number one threat to our current forest cover in the United States is not so much logging or wildfires, but it's really has to do with just encroaching commercial and residential development in rural areas. And we lose a lot of forest that way. The other thing that I mentioned in the forest context, but it holds true in non-forestry as well, has to do with conservation easements on farmland, ranch lands. The Conservation Reserve Program that some of you know is a very important tool for us to try and keep grasslands and important wildlife habitat in agriculture. And once again, that has to, when you think about the amount of carbon release when you're constantly tilling and farming a piece of land versus leaving it retired, it's a significant difference. So the last thing I'll leave you with here is that the last administration, like I was mentioning, compiled all this stuff. I mentioned three big buckets. There are a lot of sort of sub programs underneath that I'm happy to go into. And they tabulated all those programs that we've authorized through past farm bills and other measures to reduce about 136 million metric tons of CO2 equivalent through 2025. So through the life of these programs and that we hope to reauthorize in this next farm bill, that's a significant reduction. And I think, I'll just use these last couple minutes before 8:30 Eastern where I am to basically, look ahead. I think that we're really trying to figure out where we can find areas for bipartisan and consensus support. It is no secret that we've got one party controlling the executive branch and the two houses of Congress. And for us, that doesn't mean, oh no, throw our hands up because these are sometimes politically difficult issues, but instead let's redouble our efforts to try and build bipartisan bridges, look at policies that, perhaps aren't as aggressive as some would like, but we could actually still get traction on, get a toehold on, and work across the aisle. I think people are very excited about some of the things coming out of the House Climate Solutions Caucus. There are certainly more and more you're reading about senators, even Republican senators over here saying positive things on climate change. And, for our part, the politics are where they are on this issue. And there's, you can sort of be disappointed and sort of give up or try and really keep those dialogues going and keep building those bridges. So we're looking for opportunity. I'm sure that Tom Driscoll, when you guys spoke with him last week, talked a little bit about how important climate is to NFU. I know NSAC feels the same way. And we've been talking with Tom and trying to encourage them to use their grassroots membership, work with guys like you to really go to some of these legislators and try and articulate why these are such important issues for rural America and, that we ought to be looking at a science-based solution to these problems and one that's commensurate with the significant challenge that we face. So I'll probably stop there.
Thank you very, very much.
Thank you guys so much. It's been a real pleasure. We'll talk to you all again soon.
Yes, I hope so. Thank you. And I also, before we sign off, I want to let people know that next week we are going to be talking to someone from American Forests. So tonight might have been the first time we heard that forests are, number one, under agriculture, and number two, a big part of the carbon sequestration solution. So that's next week. So until then, I guess we'll sign off.